Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
Sitting here talking to my buddy Dave, like on the phone, laughing about a bunch of bull. Good morning, Dave. How are you over there? Where are you at, the 901?
Well, no, I'm in Tony, Alabama, over here on Cripple Goose Avenue. Just checking in with you at 316 Gimmick Street.
Surely you jest. You cannot be on Cripple Goose Avenue.
I might be just a little bit jesting.
Hey, man, we talk all the time. But what a lot of people don't know is where these damn championship belts come from. And you're one of the premier, if not the premier maker of these championship belts. So I figured we'd carry a little conversation and talk about the process because, man, when you get into the business of pro wrestling, as I was and as you're a huge fan of, I know you're a huge fan of the USWA territory down there in Tennessee and, wrestling worldwide. But, man, those gold belts mean everything to you. And if you ain't in the business to have one of them belts, you got no business being in it, as I used to always say. But as a kid, you were growing up back in the day, and you were a big fan. And so y'all just started making some championship belts out of cardboard. Was that the start?
That was the start, man. We didn't have anything else. We were out in the sticks. We had three channels and nothing to do but fight and whatever else. So it's like, one morning I flipped on the TV and I was watching Jerry Lawler and Dutch Mantell. And I said, you know what? I need one of those Southern belts. So I made myself one of those versions out of a little, started with cardboard and some aluminum foil and, went from there. And obviously the materials have gotten a little better as we've gone along.
Boy, I'll say, how old were you when you first started watching the business?
I was really in and out of it when I was growing up. When I was a little kid, my older brother was really into it, and I just kind of in and out of it. And I think it really probably hit me for good when I was about 12 or 13 years old, and I was hooked. And from there on, I was pretty religious with it.
I know you're real fond of the Memphis territory, as I am. Would you say that's your favorite territory in all the pro wrestling you've watched throughout your life?
I think it's got to be. You can probably relate to this a little bit. I mean, what you grow up with is what you what you kind of cling to. It's what you go with. And growing up just outside of Memphis, I mean, that was kind of my thing. And good. Well, I was real fortunate though because Memphis got to be one of those areas by 85 or so. We were getting everything. Everything that was syndicated. So we had World Class, we had Mid-South, we had even WWF started coming in there at the time. So, I mean, we were getting a little bit of everything by 85. And, just to see the Watts territory blew me away. I was like, man, they put these main event things on TV. If you want to see the main event in Memphis, you had to go to the Coliseum. So to get that stuff was just awesome.
Man, what was I know you're pretty close with Jerry the King Lawler. I know he's one of my favorites. He's one of my favorite workers. And he's one of my favorite talkers. Who else that was down there in that period of time, or in general, that guys that you looked up to or liked what they were doing?
I think most of the major feuds, of course, revolved around Jerry. And I mean, so you got the stuff with Bill Dundee, who is one of the most underrated guys ever in the business.
I think Bill Dundee ought to be in the damn Hall of Fame.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, what has that man not done? Besides, I mean, 5'7", 205, 210 pounds, filling up arenas as both a booker and a worker. I mean, how do you beat that?
He drew money. I tell you what, when I look at, the WWE Hall of Fame, man, if they want to put a cat in it, I think superstar Bill Dundee, man. When I came down there, and it was greener than grass, and it wasn't too long before I was working with superstar Bill Dundee. We were having first blood matches, and to those people that don't know what a first blood match is, it's when the first person to make his opponent bleed wins the match. And I was working with Dundee in those kind of matches and just regular matches, any kind of matches. And, when I first went in there, I was pretty jacked up, about 6'2", about 250.
I remember.
And I remember, I was like, man, working with Bill Dundee, I thought, I got to work like a big man. Well, you're going to sell for Bill Dundee because he's going to get his shit in. And I loved working with that guy. You talk very smart. He always made me look good. He made himself look good. He let me get some heat. He always got the win, as he should have, but he really took me under his wing and really helped me out. I really got a lot of respect for superstar Bill Dundee. He treated me like gold. And that guy, man, you talk about promos. Some of those old vignettes they did back in the USWA days, whether it was Jerry Lawler or Bill Dundee, bad reputation on the motorcycle, all that stuff. Right. I mean, they were way ahead of their time. They were putting out some damn good TV.
Absolutely. You know, as a little side note to all the praise for Bill Dundee, you know, I got to run some shows and did that for a while in the 90s, and Bill came and worked for me some. And we had this guy from St. Louis in there who was just a what I call kind of a high spot monkey. I mean, he was 100 miles, and he could do some incredible stuff, but he was 100 miles an hour and never slowed down. So right. Bill had him in the corner one night talking to him, and suddenly, why they call him high spots is because it's the high point of the match. If you don't slow down, nobody appreciates it. You know, and so finally Bill talked.
Say that one more time.
They call him high spots because it's the high point in the match. If you don't slow down, nobody appreciates it.
God, that's good shit there.
And he's got these. Until finally, he gets red in the face and he turns around and says, "Ah, damn it, son, I can't talk to him. I need you to go try it. You try it. I'm done with him."
What happened?
He didn't listen, and he went back to St. Louis. That's why.
You know, but what Dave's getting at here, you know, when you send the cat into the ropes, you go into motion. That's a high spot, and you know the whole match just can't be hitting the ropes, bing bang boom, for the sake of hitting the ropes and all this action and bolt. It has to mean something. So it's transition of a match of a guy trying to get out of a hold. So as important as high spots are. What Dave is saying and what Bill Dundee was trying to tell this high spot artist was it wasn't all about the movement. It's about the story. And high spots are important, but so are the work holds. And I won't call them rest holds because they're not supposed to be rest holds. But right. There's periods that there's got to be commas, periods, and exclamation points in those matches. And that's what Bill was trying to lay into this cat in the corner that night. I cut you off. We got segued, but talk about some other guys from that territory in the heyday there, Dave.
You know, our buddy Dutch Mantell, man, both of us, you know, of course you got a very strong connection with Dutch because of your history there. And I think most people know about that. And, you know, you got Dutch, man. Dutch is just such a, I mean, just such an incredible worker on all fronts. I mean, and, you know, of course, you know, this is not the conventional thing, but you're talking Memphis. You got to talk about the Andy Kaufman thing. And Andy came in and had that run and with Jerry, and that was just so surreal to be sitting in the crowd. I remember sitting there one night and Andy Kaufman shows up unannounced. They didn't use him to draw money that night because he just showed up unannounced, got in the ring to start berating people and getting heat, and it was just awesome. And as a little side note to that, you asked the King one time who the Colossus of Death was. You remember asking him?
Yeah. And I found out, but tell me his name.
Duke Myers.
I had a bunch of people send in some emails to my show, and they said that the Colossus of Death was Duke Myers.
Right, but you know we were such a hotbed down there, man. I mean, you know, and Austin Idol had a great run with Jerry. So much of it centered around Jerry because you know being a top guy in the territory. And,
well, let's talk about that. The whole territory centered around Jerry. And going back to Dutch, you know, as many people know or those that don't know, I was 2 months in the business when I asked Jerry Jarrett, and I was in Dallas. And Jerry had just bought in the Dallas portion of, well, bought World Class Championship Wrestling, and was going to, you know, merge it into USWA. The bulk of the territory was in Tennessee. So, you know, they was beating me up for 2 months, getting heat on me, the hills coming through. And I asked Jerry, I said, when can I start working full time? And he says, hell, I think you're ready now. He was wrong, but nonetheless, there I am driving my Hyundai Excel to the Mid-South Coliseum. And I got there first guy in the building and sitting there walking around the dressing room, ain't a soul in. And here comes Ricky Morton smoking a cigarette. And, of course, I know who Ricky is, but he don't know who the hell I am. And I stuck my hand out, and I said, Steve Williams. And he goes, Ricky Morton. He just kind of looked at me. You know, he looks you up and down the way Ricky does. He goes, can you work? And I said, well, you know, because Ricky all about to work, right? One of the greatest of all time. And I said, well, I guess that's what they're, you know, I'm here to do. And so then I met Dutch Mantell. He changed my name to Steve Austin. And, you know, by the way, it worked out with everybody. You know, the territory was kind of down. We weren't making a whole lot of money, especially me. I wasn't making shit. Well, Dutch needed someone to ride with, and as did Chris Champion, so we're riding down the road. And I'm getting all my 411 sprinkled on my brain. It was a sponge, and he was the water dropping in this information, psychology, stories. You know Dutch, smart guy who loves to talk and is a great talker. And I remember one time he had been sassing me, and we had developed a little bit of chemistry from all the miles that we had put together. And I finally looked over and I said, Dutch, let me tell you something. And he goes, you're never going to tell me nothing. He goes, you can ask me something, but you can never tell me anything because you don't know. So anyway, that was my relationship with Dutch, but an extremely important figure in my career. I want to talk about the stories revolving around Jerry Lawler, and then you had Dutch Mantell, a strong personality, and, of course, Bill Dundee. So three top guys, you know, all in the mix. Lawler, probably the kingpin, but how was that? Was it chemistry? Was it animosity? Was it, you know, guys, how was their working relationship? Because I know it was very, very competitive there.
It's been my experience with all those guys, and I'm fortunate enough to know them all pretty well. It's been my experience with those guys that, you know, they're kind of like brothers, and that means they can say what they want to about each other, but you better not. And,
right.
And I just got that kind of admiration for all of them based on that, because that's their deal. I mean, Jerry and Dutch are actually born literally on the same day. I don't know if you knew that or not. Not just the same birth, literally the same day.
Yeah.
But hours apart, you know, and those guys are just, the chemistry there is just unbelievable. Dutch, in my opinion, of course, he's, you know, doing the WWE run now, but I mean, Dutch, again, one of the most underrated guys for all aspects of the business. What has this guy not done? You know,
and a great mind for the business, because I mean he booked USWA for a while. He booked Memphis, but he booked a lot of successful periods in Puerto Rico. Went down to TNA, and TNA was booking down there, and then he was booking the Knockout division. Brought that up, then they jettisoned him off for some reason, of which I don't know. But a great mind for the business,
and one of the guys that I picked up phrases from without even trying to, because now, and people don't get it, guys like you get it, if I say we can get around with each other, you'll say something, you know, and it's a little off the wall, but you say, oh, don't get hot about it.
Yeah, that's where I got that. And we'd be riding down the road, and he asked me a question, I'd give him an answer, and he'd just go, well, don't get hot about it, like you were really mad. I stole that from Dutch Mantell myself.
Me too.
What else did you steal from him?
Well, you know, nothing I want to talk about because there might be some charges in there somewhere.
We don't want to get anybody. We don't want to get anybody in trouble. Hey, man, there was some great tag team action over there as well during the heyday.
Oh man, you kidding? I mean, you know, people look at those Fabulous Ones vignettes now, and they're like, "Oh, that's so." But you know, you just got to. Everything is relative to the time period, and you got to understand, man. And you know, in 1983. These guys were just over like crazy, you know. I mean, you got, of course, you know, Jerry, again, it goes back to Jerry Lawler, the great tag teams with Bill Dundee and Austin Idol and all these guys.
Right.
I mean, you know, when you talk tag teams, man, you got to talk Steve Kern and Stan Lane. I mean, geez, those guys were just incredibly over. It was just, they started the whole thing that led to the Fantastics, the Rock and Roll Express, all these spinoff teams. And no disrespect to those teams, but that's, you know, they were created in the mold of the Fabulous Ones.
Were the Fabulous Ones indeed before the Rock and Roll?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. I mean, obviously, I'm a big fan of the Fabulous Ones, and Steve Kern and Stan Lane, I mean, back in the day, two good-looking cats, and, man, they started putting these little vignettes together, and I think if you probably went on YouTube, you could find these things, but, man, when you look at them now, they're kind of a little bit campy or hokey, but that's just because we're in 2014. Back in the day, that was cutting edge. And sharp dress, man, all that stuff. And it was gold. And those guys were superstars. And they could work their ass off. And they both had a ton of fire. So, brother, when they were selling, you wanted them to come back. And when they started coming back, you cheered for them because they had fire and people believed in their ass.
Absolutely, man. I'm going to tell you something. If you go back and you can find, like, the Fabs and the Moondogs, I mean, these things were bloodbaths. You know, these weren't just pretty. A lot of people that just see the vignettes think, well, they're kind of pretty boys or whatever. And Kern and Lane were made in the mold.
Pretty boys, but those guys were tough.
Of the Fabulous Fargos is what they were supposed to be, you know,
right,
representing. And so, I mean, they do bloodbaths, man. I mean, these things were just, if for anybody out there that hasn't seen them, I encourage you to go look up some of these Fabulous One Sheepherders or Fabulous One Moondogs matches, and you'll see what Steve and I are talking about, because, I mean, this was, they were a huge reason that Memphis was such a hotbed of tag team wrestling.
Hey, were you there before we segue and we actually talk about the belt making process and more about that? Because it's all about the championship goal today. Were you there on the infamous Bill Dundee motorcycle incident?
I was not there. I know all about it, you know, but I somehow or another, that's one of the rare nights that I missed in that time period. I actually didn't even realize it happened in Memphis. I thought it happened in like Louisville or something until I think our buddy Jim Cornette had said it was Memphis, and then I never questioned. If Jim said it was Memphis, it was Memphis. So
yeah, I just know it happened, but you weren't there that night.
Yeah, no, I hate that I missed that, but I'm glad I wasn't sitting in the front row. I'll tell you that.
Bill Dundee in the spotlight hit him on that motorcycle. It careened out of control. What is it, out of all the stuff, because, I mean, USWA was one of the premier territories for just kind of some off-the-wall angles. What were some of the angles that you really enjoyed?
Craziest stuff I saw. You know, I think that craziest stuff I saw was just goes back to how intense it was back then, and it's really not like a crazy gimmick match or anything, but just to show you just how crazy things could get in the Mid-South Coliseum. I remember the night that Austin Idol shaved Jerry Lawler's head. There was a guy climbing the cage trying to get to Jerry. I knew the guy, and he was climbing the cage trying to get to Jerry. That's how serious it was. But as far as some of the craziest stuff, as far as the gimmick stuff, one thing about, you could tell when the King was booking or had a heavy influence in the booking, even before he got to be kind of a co-owner in the territory, because you'd see Dr. Frank, or you'd see, and later on, probably just before you came in, they had a run with Nightmare Freddy, who was a Freddy Krueger guy. So King liked to book those monster deals, you know, had the Jason and Leatherface and all these guys. So that really probably for a wrestling match, that's some of the, seeing a guy named Ken Raper doing Leatherface rip-off gimmick, and he's carrying an actual chainsaw that's running. It's probably one of the craziest things I think I ever saw.
The thing that I remember so much about being in the USWA territory, Dave, was, man, for a while there I was riding around with Dr. Tom Pritchard, and Tom was on top. Tom's a hell of a damn worker, you know that, and a hell of a promo guy. And by some way, somehow, we were forced to ride together. Well, we wasn't making no money. And Dirty White Boy, Tony Anthony, had gone to Japan. And so Tom was driving that car, and I had my Hyundai Excel. I think when I had came back, and I wasn't riding with Dutch and Chris Champion anymore. And so, you know, Tom needed a riding partner, so I was that guy. And we were from totally different spectrums. Tom would kind of wake up and do his thing, and I would wake up and do my thing, and then all of a sudden we get in the car together, and it was just nothing but complete silence as we went down the road. And then we started talking, and then we became the best of friends, and we started to learn each other. And, man, I tell you what, hanging out and driving up and down the road and asking that guy questions was a wealth of information. And it was riding with Tom Pritchard one time. We were riding down the road, and we were going to a town. It was myself, Tom, and Brian Lee. And Tom looked over at me, and I was stunning Steve Austin at the time. Then Dutch had just gave me that name. And Tom looks over at me, and he says, "Steve, you're stunning Steve, right?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, what's so stunning about you?" He goes, "Brian, you're primetime Brian Lee, right?" "Yeah." "What's so primetime about Brian Lee?" And I said, "Ain't nobody ever asked me that before. I didn't know who or what stunning Steve was. All it was to me was a name that Dutch Mantell had given me. It wasn't nothing I had thought about as far as creating." Tom was the first guy to give me a clue as to, you know, thought behind a character or gimmick to give that thing some depth. You know, it was just a name tag to me. So Tom was one of the guys that opened my eyes up to that. But the story that I wanted to tell about Tom was, half almost the whole time I was down there, that was a blade-heavy territory. There was a lot of bleeding going on to put asses in seats back in the day. And I tell you what, Tom had a damn open wound on his forehead. You could basically just barely thump him with your finger, and he'd start bleeding. And he would land. And that was just a night-in, night thing here. And that was the way Tennessee operated. They loved blood in that territory. I'm telling you, when I got out there with the superstar in those first blood matches, I mean, it was a bloodbath, mister. And that was the thing that I enjoyed so much back in the day.
Well, I think the important thing is it was definitely a blood-heavy territory, but, you know, it was they're trying to use it to make it mean something.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, but you know, going back to Dr. Tom, also one of my favorite guys. I love Tom Pritchard. I don't I don't see how there was ever any silence in the car with you and Dr. Tom. And I never really got to know Brian Lee that much. I was around him a little bit. But
yeah.
I know Dr. Tom real well, too. So I was like, if there was silence at all between you two guys, a little bit surprising. But, yeah, as far as the blood goes, man, Doc was one of those guys, too, that he wanted to make sure it made sense when he asked you who was stunning Steve. Well, that's Doc all the way. Doc's a psychology guy. It's got to make sense to him. But that was the beauty of pro wrestling back then. I mean, you know, it was supposed to make sense. If it didn't make sense, and that's one of the things even when I tried to run my little shows, it's like it's real simple. Booking is not hard. If it makes sense, you know, you go with it. And so often that's lost, and it's just people that...
Stop right there. Booking is not hard. If it makes sense, go ahead.
You go with it. And it's just, I had, when I was running shows, my oldest nephew was about 5 years old, and he would sit there, and we would be, you know, my kids, my nephews, they were around the business stuff. They'd listen to us talk, and they would say, and sometimes he'd say, well, Uncle Dave, that don't make sense. And if he ever stopped and said, that don't make sense, I rethought the whole thing, because here, you know, out of the mouths of babes kind of thing, but the boys started calling my nephew, who was about, I said five, he was a little older than that time, you know, eight, nine, whatever he was, but they started calling him the booker. And when I'd walk in without the booker, they'd be like, where's the booker? Because he was the check.
Yeah.
You know, he was the measuring stick to make sure it made sense.
You know, and that's another thing I enjoyed about the USWA territory was, okay, it was, you know, basically most of the guys lived in Nashville. You know, Jerry's always been a Memphis guy. But the territory, the towns were, Memphis was Monday night. Louisville, Kentucky was Tuesday night. Evansville, Indiana was Wednesday night. That's where we got paid. Thursday was usually a spot show. So when you go to the spot show, everybody would leave their cars in the parking lot and jump on the tour bus, Waylon Jennings' tour bus that Jerry leased, and we'd drive all night after the spot show to go to Dallas. And that spot show was usually within 100, 120 miles of Nashville. Everybody get on the bus, drive all night to make Dallas by, you know, sometime in the early afternoon. All the boys would go get a gym workout or get a tan or whatever, do their thing, and then we'd work Dallas Sportatorium Friday night. And then right after that, everybody'd take a shower, go to the liquor store, which was right next door, buy beer or whiskey or whatever, get back on a bus. We would drive all night to go to Memphis. We'd make Memphis by Saturday morning and do live TV. And after TV, you get a shower, get in your car. No, you get back on the bus, they'd drop you off at the parking lot on the spot show from Thursday, and then you would drive back to your hotel, get a shower, and you would work Nashville Saturday night. And then maybe you would work Sunday if there was a show booked. But you had to, you know, working that often in the same towns every single night, over and over and over again, you had to change your shit up because you were forced to, and your chops come up at a real high rate of speed when you're working like that, working the same place over and over again, because you can get on a big loop later, you know, when you're hitting everything once, twice, three times a month, about once every 2-3 months, and get locked into a program and kind of go through the motions, not there. And that's what I loved about the USWA.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, that's a lot of people today that are more recent fans don't understand that. And they talk about, well, Memphis is a great example. Well, Jerry Lawler did this, Jerry Lawler did that. But it was week in and week out. They don't understand that WWE might hit a major town twice a year, if that, you know, and these guys were hitting these towns. I mean, you know, including yourself when you came through, hitting these towns every week. And you gotta come up with something fresh. And there's going to be times it gets a little stale, and that's when you pick it up. And you know, in the case of Memphis, they would change the booker over. And I think Jerry Lawler, Jerry Jarrett, and even Bill Dundee got involved in that too, and Dutch did too later on. They just swapped the book off, you know, every 6 months or so to try to keep something going. And you know, and they did really last longer than if you really look back at it. They outlasted the rest of the territory. There's a reason for that.
Right. Well, anyway, man, I just want to talk to you a little bit because, man, every time we get on the phone, we end up talking about the business. We talk about those old days and riding down the road.
That's right. It sounds like one of our phone calls, man. We kind of let everybody listen to what our phone calls sound like. So that's what we did right there.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
Hey, Hey, y'all, this is producer Sean G back at you, here to tell you more about Concrete. Now, what is Concrete? It's what's been changing the game for me lately, health and fitness-wise, and all over, really. What is Concrete? It's the powerful nutrient creatine clinically proven to not just power muscles, but also power our immune system and our T-cells. T-cells are key to maintaining good health and are the first responders of your immune system. And creatine, like I've said before, is not just for working out. I always assumed that it was just sort of a supplement strictly for working out and building muscles, but creatine is required for functional energy in every cell of your body. Immune cells need it to have the energy to fight off bad cells and protect the body. Heart cells need it to pump. Lung cells need it to breathe. Every cell must have creatine to function at its best. And that's why it's truly been changing the game for me in the gym and in the office. I feel a little sharper during meetings, and I feel a little more pep in my step when I'm in the gym. So, optimize your health and fitness, both body and mind. Build a better you with Concrete. And if you register now at concrete.com/podcast, you can win a free membership to Planet Fitness for an entire year, plus a $500 Walmart Visa gift card. That's concrete.com/podcast to be one of multiple winners. And Concrete is now available online and in store at Walmart. Concrete is truly changing fitness and health.
I'm sitting here talking to my buddy Dave Millick on the phone. And right now I'm on Dave's website, and you can check it out, DaveMillikenBelts.com. And you can also follow Dave on Twitter, at Dave Millikin. So anyway, man, I'm looking at all these badass belts. And I know when you got your start, first of all, you started making your belts for yourself and your friends and using that cardboard and stuff. And then you kind of graduated from some tin into heavier materials. And so you were learning this process by yourself, and you were doing pretty good. Who was teaching you back in the day before you hooked up with Reggie Parks, who was the king of belts?
Well, nobody was teaching me, but I was definitely emulating everything that I could of Reggie's work. Reggie was just far and away the guy. And
but did you have any metalworking schools from anything in high school, or you just started just working with metal?
No, I just started working with metal. I had an uncle that worked in a road machinery place, and he was seeing some of the stuff I was doing, and I was cutting up serving trays and kind of goofy stuff. And
yeah.
He said, man, there's a better way than this. We can beat this. And he said, draw me some templates out on cardboard. Come to work with me. We'll cut them out of the steel. We'll buff the rust off the steel, make it shiny, and then you can kind of work with it from there. So, that was kind of the start of getting into metal. I was a couple of years into it, and I was using everything I could find. And my uncle kind of helped me out and got me going with some metal. And from there, I started using trophy pieces on the metal. And by then, I'm selling to some of the little outlaw shows and things like that. And, it just kind of went from there until, I never tried to get Reggie's attention. Reggie Parks, who was without Reggie, there'd be no belt business. But I never tried to get his attention. I just wanted to order one of his belts because he was the best.
And, Reggie Parks is from Canada. He wrestled in Stampede, wrestling for Stu Hart. Had a long career. And reached the end of his wrestling career, got into the belt making business, and probably started in the late 60s. So there in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, all the badass belts, the beautiful belts, were pretty much made by Reggie Parks. Now, I know that he was a big influence for you, and I want to get into that that part of the story. But there was another co-worker of his back in the day, Nikita Mulkovich, who was making belts around that era as well. I didn't know if you'd ever seen or come across any of the belts that he was making. I don't think he was quite on Reggie's class.
He was kind of a different, he went a different way, and he made a lot of high-profile belts, too. He was really the only guy that was competing with Reggie for that business, and he did what we call cast belts, and he would make these molds, and he was really, really good at it. They were crude compared to Reggie's belts,
right.
But they were still, he made some iconic belts. I mean, the belt that Superstar Graham and Bruno and Bob Backlund wore, he made that one with the big eagle across the front. So Mulkovich made some great stuff, and I've been fortunate enough to track down and own a couple of his belts at different times. But, I never crossed paths with him, and he's passed away, and I've been able to go back and remold some of his stuff and work with it. And You know, he definitely was an artisan, definitely was a craftsman in his own right, no doubt about it. To me, nothing beats the Reggie Parks belt, but Nikita Mokovic, a real name, Alex Molko, and he was quite a craftsman himself. I think somebody in his family actually told us that he went on and stopped making belts and got into making violins. So, I mean, he was just an all-around craftsman.
Oh, so well, that's interesting. So, fast forward, and you're making your belts, and you're doing pretty good. You're selling some to some outlaw organizations or indie-type right. things. You wanted a belt, and so you called the man, Reggie Parks, the king of belts, and you guys kind of struck up a conversation, and you bring up, hey, by the way, I make belts, and he says, hey, send me some pictures.
Exactly. That's exactly how it happened. And I thought, you know, and he was, because that's just Reggie. Reggie's just such a nice guy. And I just thought he was being nice. And, you know, I called him back the next week after he got the pictures, and he says, man, there's a lot of potential there. You should, why don't you do this like I do it? Well, you know, that about knocked me out. It's a good thing I wasn't on a chair, because it would knock me off of it. I wasn't prepared for that at all. And I said, I'd love to. And he started opening some doors for me and helping me out. And we went from there. But, you know, it started off, he kind of figuratively held my hand through that whole process at first, because I knew nothing about the etching process and the way that Reggie was making his belts. You know, the stuff I was copying, I was still using everything by hand, my steel that I cut out of my uncle's shop and just, you know, using this different embroidering paints and things to raise the artwork on the plates. And everything was going to be well below the quality of Reggie's belts. And it wasn't as simple back then. It's just, well, let's get on the internet and Google it and see how he does this.
Right.
So I didn't have a clue how he was making those plates. And so he just opened that door in a completely unexpected way. I never asked Reggie for that. I would have never been gutsy enough to ask Reggie for anything like that.
But now you're based out of the Memphis area, right?
Right.
And then Reggie's based out of Tucson, Arizona. Did you ever make the ride to Tucson and hang out with him one-on-one and go through the process, or this is just all over the phone?
No, it was all over the phone, and you know, we were keeping FedEx busy, and you know, I've still not, you know, of course, knowing everything and being handling my business through still the same engraving company in Tucson that Reggie started with, but I don't spend time in Tucson now. I'm down here in the South. We just keep FedEx real happy now, you know.
Right. Is Reggie still making some belts?
He is. Reggie's in his late 70s now, so he's slowed down considerably. But yes, he is still making belts. Much more slowed down these days, you know, from when we were running real hot together. And
but I mean, he probably just loves the process and doing it more than anything. I mean, because
he does.
You pretty much have the bulk of everything out there. I mean, like, you're making belts for WWE, WCW. You made belts for World Class Championship Wrestling, TNA, UFC, WEC, Ring of Honor, Bellator. I mean, and probably some stuff over in Japan. What else are you making right now that I haven't mentioned?
Well, I mean, there's even these smaller MMA organizations. This week I'm working on, I got a regular client in California. It's a casino in California, runs MMA fights. So, I mean, they're just kind of all over the place. You know, you talked to Gabriel Iglesias the other day, and I mean, you know, made a belt through his management team for him. So, I mean, you just never know. They're made for a little bit of everything. You know, Reggie opened such doors for me, though, and I get kind of credited with some of the stuff that Reggie did, because I've recreated so much of it. And, you know, I try to never take credit for what Reggie did, because, you know, Reggie was making those belts, those WCW belts and things like that, and the world-class belts. And even my own web guy at one point in time was throwing stuff up left and right, because he's seen so many of these belts for me. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, but you got to know the original started with Reggie. I always like to make sure that credit goes where it's due. But, yeah, tons of stuff for Japan, man, IWGP belts, Pro Wrestling NOAH belts over there. So, I mean, you know, they're worldwide. We sent belts to Russia last year.
You know, that's funny because, you know, I mean, you and me talk, and, you know, when you and me talk, it's just two cats. And I just think, I'm talking to Dave today. Man, this is a hell of a workload. Take me through, I mean, you know, what your normal day or week is, because, I mean, dude, you're trying to crank out a pile of belts here for one cat.
Right. Man, that's just it. There is no normal week for me. I mean, one week might be working around the clock trying to meet a WWE deadline or deadline for Bellator or something along those lines. And the next week might just be, you know, all collector belts. And while there's still pressure to get them out, there's nothing like the pressure of meeting those deadlines. You know, you can't tell people that have millions of dollars on the line for a pay-per-view event, well, sorry, the belt didn't get done. So, but you know, as far as you know, I mean, sometimes again, it's round the clock for me, and I don't stop until I've got a project finished. And other times, you know, I'll do an 8, 10, or 12 hour day like normal folks. So, there's just absolutely no normal weeks for me because it's all over the map.
Now, I know if you're getting the plates or some of the artwork done in Tucson, everything gets FedEx back to you. You're the cat actually attaching it to, you know, doing everything but attaching it to that leather strap, right?
Right. I mean, we start with our process starts if it's something custom, something we haven't done before. I mean, you know my buddy Rico, man.
I was fixing to bring Rico up. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Can't leave out Rico. Rico came to us 12-14 years ago, came to us and was just some really, really very cool design work. And
so Rico Mann is how would you describe him? He's a designer, he's a computer guy.
Because
he came into play when didn't WWE send, or WWF at the time send you down a belt and you needed some more detail in it? And then did you reach out to Rico? How'd you guys get together to start working on this stuff?
He reached out to me, and and it really wasn't that uncommon. I was getting I still get offers from people saying, "Hey, what about using my designs?" And you know, I'm not really out shopping for them because just no real need to. But something about Rico's stuff really caught my eye, and I talked to our partner at the time, who's passed away, Ed Schumann. I said, "Hey, Ed, you know, I'm really busy with what I'm working on, but take a look at this guy's stuff. We need to talk to him." And so that's how that got started. And what it was UFC had sent us a belt that somebody else had made for them, and they're like, you know, we own this art, this is our base design, but we really want to jazz it up. And so Rico took that thing, man, and turned it around and made the iconic UFC belts, the same style that they're still using today. And so, you know, Rico, that was probably Rico's first big claim to fame, along with some of the Japanese stuff they designed. And but you know, now fast forward a little, you know, to where we're at now, Rico's a full-fledged business partner, not just designer. Rico handles is our managing partner of our organization, that handles a lot of our big deals, because I just don't have time to stay on the phone handling that type stuff, because I'm doing the hammering on the leather and the gold plating and this and that. So Rico comes in very, very handy in that regard too.
Man, I'm sitting here looking at the NWA television heavyweight wrestling title.
Kind of familiar with that one, aren't you?
A little bit familiar. Got one in my safe. Here's my question. And it's one of my favorite belts of all time. But anyway, so I'm looking at this belt. It's a badass-looking belt. So all of a sudden, someone comes to you and says, "Dave, we need a belt. We need it ASAP." How soon, what's the timeline on cranking out a belt? And that's a pretty simple belt. So let's just talk of average decoration. How long would it take from start to finish? Once you get the go-ahead green light, we must have it now.
We could make a belt like that in a couple or a few weeks. The problem comes in, though, in the volume to make a living and especially be successful in this business. Mm-hmm. The volume is so high that we're backed up for collector's value in a couple of years sometimes. I mean, it's just crazy. And I try to warn everybody up front, the companies keep me so busy. You know, if you're a collector wanting these belts, it'll last you a lifetime if you take care of it. But don't expect to get it next month or you know, now, not even the next 6 months. It's just that backed up and that crazy. Because as you know from the belts you've held and the belts you own, you know, you look at them and these things aren't stamped out in an hour.
Oh, hell no. You know, a lot of workmanship in there.
Right. So the collectors have to kind of suffer that, because I can't tell the company that I have contracts with and where I make, you know, a bulk of my living that and not only that, like I said, you can't tell them they got these big events. Well, your belt's not going to be done because Billy Bob wants his TV belt to put on the shelf. And I'm not disrespecting the collectors now. Don't take that way, because they're, you know, but I just mean, you know, there's no timeline for them as far as there's no $1 million, you know, millions of dollars in events tied up and that kind of thing. So our deals with WWE, Bellator, these companies keep us so busy and so tied up that the collectors wait a long, long time. But in a rush order situation, I mean, we've done them in a couple of weeks. But everything else has to stop. Everything, you know, you talk about a simple one like a TV belt. I mean, not everything else has to stop or something like that, but generally the companies, you know, especially these days, they're not as big a fans of those classic belts like the TV belt that you and I love, and they want to kind of reinvent the wheel, and These things sometimes have thousands of jewels that we're setting in them, and they have different layers to them and all this stuff. And it just takes a lot of time.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
Hey, man, do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. And I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with GEICO. GEICO makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to GEICO.com. Get a quote and see how much you could save. It's GEICO easy. Visit GEICO.com today. That's GEICO.com. Hey, man, I was reading before we talked, and we talk all the time, but before we talked on the show, I was reading about some of your favorite belts. And I'm not going to go through the whole top 10 thing, but what are a couple of the belts? And I know, like you said, it's like asking a father to pick his favorite kid. But what are some of the favorite belts that you've seen or made that are really special to you?
Man, I love the classic belts. You know that. I mean, I know everybody out there doesn't know, but you know it. We've had that talk so many times. I love the classic belts. You mentioned that TV belt. That's one of them. The WWF belt that, you know, you weren't the biggest fan of, but it's just iconic for Reggie, and it's iconic for me. The one you retired when you beat Shawn.
Which one? The Winged Eagle.
The Winged Eagle belt. Yeah. That's just such an iconic belt, and I just love that belt and what symbolizes and all the guys that wore it.
That belt is sitting in my safe. It's still got the one broken wing on it, and that's why I was retired. And but anyway, that belt sits in my safe. Keep going.
Yeah, of course. You know, how am I not going to add the 10 pounds of gold, the NWA World Heavyweight Belt in there? I mean, you know about my book with my buddy Dick Warren, 10 pounds of gold, and I mean geez, when you're growing up in the time frame that we grew up in, that was the World Heavyweight Title. So, I mean, how do you not love that belt when you're in our age range? And I love it. I adore that belt, and as well as the big gold belt that followed it up, the really expensive belt, Ric Flair big gold belt. You know, that's one of them. Man, the world class belt. You know, I mean, Kerry Von Erich's belt that unified with Jerry's AWA belt. Man, that was, you know, all of those classic belts like that are mine. As far as ones I've made that I think are cool, I mean. Then we just did a camouflage belt about 6 months ago for Jay Briscoe, Ring of Honor. I love that belt just because it's unique. I'm more of a classics guy, but if you're going to get into the stuff I'm doing now, I mean, you know, I like that one because it's unique. It's the only time I've ever done a camouflage strap with shotgun shell snaps, 12-gauge snaps. So, you know, you got those. The IWGP belt, the fourth belt that Rico designed. I mean, man, that thing is wow.
Beautiful, yeah. That's a badass belt.
Yeah, so those are among the ones that I like, and you know, I could probably, if you ask me that again next week, I'd probably name
change.
Five different ones.
Hey, yeah, check it out, man!
I just passionate about it.
Hey, you know, and doing a little bit of research, and you know, kind of going back and forth on some of the belts. One of my favorite belts. I mean, it's not a favorite, but I used to love to hear the name because I always wondered what it meant. The NWA Western States Heritage Championship. That, I'm reading this straight off of Wikipedia, was a short-lived National Wrestling Alliance title in World Championship Wrestling that was filled via a tournament in the Universal Wrestling Federation in 1987 and defended in WCW until it was abandoned in 1989. Now, Barry Windham had that belt, and then I guess he dropped it to Zbyszko. I think Zbyszko bolted for AWA and took that belt with him. But I always remember when Barry came to the ring with that Western States Heritage Championship, what did that actually mean, the Western States Heritage, and it's based out of NWA.
I think we would probably have to go ask Dusty Rhodes that, because I believe that was a Dusty creation as far as the title goes. Reggie made him a beautiful belt, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
A shame that only two guys got to wear it before they did away with it. But yeah, you know, at that point in time, I mean, it got to be a little much, and I love seeing the belts, man. But I mean, gosh, Jim Crockett had so many different titles because they ran so many different towns, and they might be running two or three towns in a night. They just send champions to different, you know, so they have title matches on each card, and you're running, you know, running three times a night, you want to put title matches on each one of them. But Western States, man, I think we'd probably have to go ask Dusty, because back in those days, what happened is Dusty would just call Reggie and say, hey, man, I want a belt. I'm going to call it the Western States Heritage Belt, you know, or I'm going to call it whatever. And Reggie would be responsible for the rest of it and just come up with something. I think we'd have to ask Dusty what...
I am going to ask Dusty, now that you brought that up. I'm going to call him when I get off the damn phone with you.
Well, let me send me a text and let me know what he says, because I've always wondered, too.
Now, have you ever seen that belt in person? I mean, or do you think Zabisco was the last person that had that thing? I wonder if he's the one that has it.
Larry had the belt. I believe it ended up maybe with when Larry went to Florida and some of his other family stayed in Minnesota. I've heard it stayed
right
there. I really don't. Really don't know. I've never seen Larry produce it. The only time I ever saw it was when it was still in use, and they would come through. Crockett would run an occasional once or twice a year show in Memphis. I did see it then, but I think that was the only time I ever saw it.
Now, you make belts, you repair belts, but you also collect belts. So just as far as on the collecting side of Dave Milliken, how many collector belts do you have?
I probably all together, and I'm just guessing, I've probably got 35, 40 belts. But, I mean, as far as the ring use stuff – I'm kind of in a small circle, man. I got a few friends, and we just kind of flip them and flop them back and forth. And I think right now I've probably got 10 or so ring used belts, and got that great WCW world belt that came into play when Rick Flair took the big gold belt to WWF at the time. And so I got the one that started with Luger and went all the way through. Went all the way back to when Flair came back and he took it from Vader. So I got that one. I got one of the old AWA World Tag Belts that the Road Warriors retired. Gosh, man, I'm trying to think here. I don't have anything in front of me right now, but I got that one. I got one of the NWA belts held by everybody from the Freebirds to Tully and Arn and Rock and Roll and all those guys. So got one of the NWA Tag Belts there, and I'm pretty proud of that one. I have a WCW television belt that you have some history with. So I know you've got some stuff that we might not want to put out there, but I know you've got some stuff, and I've got one of those too, one of the old WCW TV belts.
Oh, yeah, man. I was, again, it's one of my favorite belts. Hey, I was reading that a lot of times, I mean, as a collector, you don't like to buy back your own stuff, but one of the belts you bought back was the Mid-South Wrestling North American Championship belt.
Right.
And give me the reason for that. I was reading about it, but so you saw this thing. What happened?
Well, first, if anybody is not familiar with that belt, go, look it up online. There's several North American belts. This was the last one, the gigantic North American heavyweight belt that Steve's talking about. And a buddy of mine owns that thing, and I'm the only guy that's ever been able to replicate it right off the specs of the original. And it was such a pain to do, man, just such a nightmare to do, that I told the guy that I made it for, hey, if you ever want to move this thing, I'm not going to make myself one. I don't have that kind of time to be making myself belts that are this complicated. But if you ever want to move it, let me know. And last year he said, hey, man, if you're interested, I'm going to let go of that belt. I was very interested because I wanted it, but I didn't want to.
I didn't want him to know it.
I didn't want to know just quite how much I was interested in getting it back. So, Played that little game, maybe. But, yeah, I went and bought it back, man. Generally, I'll collect an old Reggie belt or an old Malkovich belt or something. But that was one of the rare times when I went back and bought one of my own belts back because, man, that's just – they used to say it weighed 27 pounds on TV, 27 pounds of silver and gold. And it's not really 27, but it's heavy enough. I bet it's probably 14, 15 pounds and just a monster of a belt.
Hey, about a year or two ago, Ric Flair's – what belt was that was on the market for? It was the original NWA belt, correct?
It was.
Yeah, and someone had reached out to me to see if I wanted it. And of course, I wouldn't, I'm cheap. I wouldn't pay the coin for that thing. but that was the real McCoy, the belt that Harley Race had carried.
Right. It was the original belt. Rick had had a deal with some people over at Highspot or the main guy Highspots.com and. Whatever, and they didn't know it. They weren't able to come to terms on working it back out, and I think they finally did resolve it, and it went back to Rick, and then after it went back to Rick, it now actually is owned by WWE. They have it, so that's where it finally landed, and I think now that they've got it, that's where it'll stay.
But, I'm glad that the WWE ended up with that thing because that's such a special belt. I mean, at least it should belong to someone in the business or who loves the business. I think WWE is both. And such a huge part of history. I think one of these days, if WWE actually builds a physical Hall of Fame, this would be, you know, one of the most important things in there, obviously.
I've heard a lot of the people who kind of fancy themselves to be wrestling purists have a real problem with it going to WWE. I couldn't agree with you more, though. That's where it's going to be stable. That's where it's going to eventually, when they do this brick and mortar Hall of Fame, which I think will eventually happen. That's where that belt needs to be, because it needs to be.
It needs to be seen, and that's why I say that. If someone is an NWA purist, well, obviously, you know, everybody's got their own opinions. But again, for someone who is in the business now and will be for forevermore, I'm glad that WWE has that belt. And
I am too.
Yeah, I mean, here's speaking of belts. I remember, you know, when I got my first belt, and all of a sudden, you know, you go out there and. You got to hit someone in the head with these belts. And so you're going to do some damage to the belt and to the person you're hitting them with. And so these things get beat to shreds. And I remember, you know, I was a guy when I had mine, you know, I'd always pack mine in my suitcase and I would check it. Many guys wouldn't check. All the guys that had belts, probably about half checked them, half did not. And, boy, you know, it was always a state of paranoia if you lost that son of a – because, you know, that's the damn belt. But, you know, it just wasn't cool to go through the metal detector with a championship belt. At least for me it wasn't. But those things take a lot of damn damage. And I was reading about the – now with the high-def television that many times they'll have a TV belt that is not chipped up, scratched up, beat up so that it looks great on TV and that they're not traveling with that belt. So is that a correct statement?
It is correct. They're running with at least two of everything.
Right.
Our goal is to have at least two of everything. Sometimes there's as many as you know, four or five, but we're trying to have at least two of everything. And one is a road belt, like what you were describing with the talent carriers with them. You know, and in the days when you were running hot there, the belt was the belt, and you kept it with you. But now the talent has one because they're always doing, you know, appearances and whatever. So they have to have the champions have to have a belt with them. But we try to keep, in this high-def age, we try to keep the better-looking ones for TV. And even they take abuse, as you know. I
mean, oh, yeah, absolutely.
They're bounced around pretty good, but still they're bounced around a couple of times a week versus being bounced around every night of the week and through the airports and all that, because the WWE has a guy that handles the high-def belts. And keeps those with him, and so they take a lot less abuse than the road belts that talent are carrying with them. And that white intercontinental belt in particular looks rough really, really quickly when it's being, you know, put in the bag with the boots and the sweaty tights and all that, and dragged through the airports. It, in particular, that one looks rough really quick because of all the abuse it takes.
So what's the rest of your day looking like? You're talking to me on the phone, and pretty soon we're going to hang this thing up. So what's the belt you're working on currently there in the shop?
Well, in the shop today, I'm getting right back on something for a casino in California, Tachi Palace Fights. I'm going to knock out this belt over the next couple of days for them. And I'm from there, we're actually working with WWE on some more stuff that's kind of believe it or not, kayfabe is still alive in WWE, so that's really said all I'm saying right there. But
No. I like keep the information on the download. That's cool.
Yeah. So we're working on always working on something there, and then leading from that right back into another five belt Bellator order. So we're rocking and rolling with them as well.
Hey, so at any given time on the collector side of things, you know. Do you have any inventory in stock, or is this, you know, all just made-to-order stuff?
I don't. It's all made-to-order. I mean, that's kind of a misconception in this age of replica belts where you can go to WWEshop.com and pick up a replica belt. And for the people that aren't yet educated about it, sometimes they'll think, I sell those belts, and they'll say, hey, I need this belt for my kid's birthday party next week or whatever, and then I have to let them know that what I'm doing is, you know, is the high-end real stuff versus the stuff that you can get on.
Yeah, you just can't produce that in mass quantities and just expect to flip them over, because we're talking a lot of money. And I speak from experience because, you know, I reached out to you back in the day, man, and I said, Dave, I said, I want to make a belt for my ranch. I want to call it, you know, it's a Broken Skull Ranch Championship belt. And so I called you and we talked, brought in Rico Man. And we went back and forth on a couple of design things between me and him. And I told you, I said, I kind of want to pay a little homage to the old intercontinental strap that I held for a while in WWE. And I just like that classic shape without, you know, too much fanfare. And we came up with the design, and I ordered these belts from you. I got 10 of them, and it took a while, as you were swamped, as you currently are. But no, right. they're not cheap. And, you know, I've been meaning, as I told you back in the day, and this ain't a sales pitch, I've been meaning to sell these belts on the website. And, you know, frankly, right. they're so damn high, you know, it has to be a special person to be able to afford one of the damn things. So, yeah, it's cool to have one of the replicas. It really is cool. But these are the real deal, real McCoys. And so I just wondered, you know, what kind of stock you kept or how hard it was to get these things. So if anybody out there wants to reach out to Dave Milliken to get a belt, I'm sure all the big guys, the casinos, and all the corporations know of you. But what's the best way to get a hold of you, Dave? Is it via your Twitter, your website, DaveMillikenBelts.com? Are you on Facebook as well?
I'm not currently on Facebook. I've got, man, I'm just terrible about keeping the website up, and I was even worse about keeping the Facebook up, and I let that go. I'm easy to access on Twitter. You can email me directly off my website, so you can get me there. That's probably the best, is just get that link off my mmbelts12@aol.com. Get that link off my website. Email me direct is the best way, because, man, when I'm swamped, I look at my email, you know, a number of times a day on my phone, but sometimes I don't get to check Twitter for a day or two. And so really that email is probably the best way to get me, and, you know, and then we'll hook up and go from there.
Well, all right, you heard the man. He's on Twitter, Dave Milliken. Check him out on his website if you need anything. Dave, I appreciate you joining me. I'm planning on trying to get over in your neck of the woods, and when I do, we'll sit down and roll the recorder and just shoot about the wrestling business.
Man, I'm looking forward to it. I love the podcast. I love the guys you have on. I told you when you had the King on, I said, man, that's two of my favorite guys in the business. I just like being a fly on the wall there, man. It was just awesome. And we've been talking about doing this since you started this thing.
Yeah, we have.
It was great to finally do it, man. I enjoy it. Always enjoy talking to you. And, hey, when you're going to be close by, just let me know.
Will do. I'll catch you down the road, Dave. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
Hey guys, Jay Cutler. Started a new podcast called Uncut with Jay Cutler. Most of you know me from the NFL, some of you have seen me on Instagram, and some of you know me from the reality TV world. Each week I'm taking you along with me as we discuss football, trending topics, and whatever's going on in my life each week. I'm bringing along people that are special in my life, former teammates, friends, and some new people that I like and respect. That's what you're supposed to do, right? Podcasting? I think I'm doing this right. Can't wait to get started with you. Go subscribe now. Uncut with Jay Cutler, Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, and Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yo, what's good? It's your boy, Big Brother Jake, a.k.a. Jake Warner.
My government name.
Check it out. I host a show called the Big Brother Jake Podcast, and I've taken my talents to the biggest and baddest platform on the planet. That's right, baby, Podcast One. My show is unique as I talk about everything, life, sports, entertainment, being a single dad juggling several jobs. I'm a hot mess, but it's damn entertaining. Subscribe and review now on Apple Podcasts and listen on Podcast One or wherever you get your podcasts.